Friends, I decided that I'd like to begin this morning by asking you to accompany me. I'd like to propose a few moments further meditation while we consider something together. So I'd like to suggest first that you're sitting as comfortably as possible, that you are sitting four square on your seat, and if it's comfortable, to put both feet on the floor, to settle and, in the words of that prayer by Thich Nhat Hanh, to gather. Because I'd like to ask you to bring into consideration your own name. Just your first name. I'd like to ask you to dwell on it for a while, to turn it over in your mind, to, as it were, hear your name in your mind's ear. If you do this, you may be able to recall the many voices who have spoken that name, the ways in which your name has been pronounced, sometimes gently, sometimes not so gentle. Some people's names are shortened by friends. Some people have names that are spoken in full at all times. Some people's full name is only ever spoken when they're in trouble. Some people love their names and are very particular about the way it's said or the way it's shortened. Yet others spend their whole lives never really liking their name. Which is closer to the way you feel? Another question, and it's a strange question in a way, do you feel that your name suits you? We sometimes refer to a name as a handle, as if it's a way of holding you, of getting to grips with you, or defining you. But it's not really a definition. We're all much more than our identities, after all. And some people have a secret or private inward name, a name that nobody but themselves know. I'm going to count to three and ask all present to say your own name out loud. One, two, three. Joe. Thank you. So let's return to the room and open our eyes if you've had them closed. I don't know if you have that kind of secret name that no one but yourself knows. Keep it to yourself if you have. The ancients used to believe that knowing someone or something's name would give you power over that person or thing. So, for example, the city of Rome had a secret name that no one was able to share, or no one was allowed to share on pain of death. To give it away was a punishable treachery. To this day, I believe, nobody actually knows what it was, for sure. Personal gods and tribal deities' names were kept secret. The Roman army had special spies whose sole job was to go out in advance of the army and gather the name of tribal gods of the people they were fighting. They felt that a name was a vital part of the thing it described. In modern times, we don't really feel that anymore. One of the most famous lines in the whole works of Shakespeare are Juliet's "Wherefore art thou Romeo?" by which she means, "Why are you called that name in particular?" She goes on, "Oh, be some other name. What's in a name? That which we call a rose by any other name would smell as sweet." And that's essentially how we feel about the matter. The names for things, the proper names or nouns, are convenient ID tags, so we all know what things we're describing. So when I say banana, you know I mean a long yellow soft fruit and not a round green hard fruit, because we call that an apple. But if we decided to, if we agreed on it, we could easily call bananas apples and apples wombats or whatever. Nothing would be lost in the process. Nothing about the essential quality of a banana would be lost. And we know this is true because that's essentially what happens between people who speak different languages. But it's a funny thing how different names can make things appear differently. If I say, for example, Bob Dylan, this name conjures up a set of images and references and association that make it almost impossible to reconcile with the name Robert Zimmerman. But actually, we know that's his real name. There's an Argentine writer, Jorge Luis Borges, who says that after some considerable consideration, he believes that the English word for moon is the most perfect in any language. The English word for moon represents more closely than the Latin luna, or the Spanish lua, or the Hindu chandra, and so on and so on. He was a great linguist and knew whereof he spoke. Luis Borges says that somehow the word moon sounds round. He points out that it makes you shape a circle with your lips. He says that the two O's in the centre of the word resemble a moon and its own reflection. It's a lovely idea. Another example is the book we know as Exodus, I read from earlier. We know it as Exodus, but in Judaism it's given a different name altogether. It's called Shemot, which means names. In the reading we heard how God commissioned Moses. Moses first asks, "Who am I?" But then he asks the God of his ancestors, "Who are you?" And the answer that comes back is, "I am that I am." Now, there are many learned works devoted to interpreting this mysterious and wonderful saying. The Hebrew ayeh asher ayeh can mean "I am what I will be." It can even mean "I am where I will be." Many of us find it hard to sign up to a version of God that seems a reduction to a human scale. They prefer instead to acknowledge something infinitely larger than the conscious mind can grasp. I love the attempt that Paul Tillich made when he described God as the ground of all being. And in some ways, I suspect that that's exactly what the writer of Exodus or Shemot is trying to hint at. That's suggesting not a personal God in the sense of being like a person, but in the sense of being the archetype of personality, the essence of I-ness, the root from which all names and proper names can come. I think that's why I love those lists of names, like the varieties of apple that I read earlier. I love the beautiful sounds of the poetry of those names, and I also love the sense of an endlessly proliferating spiral of names, flowing out in great waves of identification and variety. There's also the hint that the lists contain and refer back to the archetype, the ancestor of all the varieties, which must lie at the beginning of the list, the applest apple, the floweriest flower, the mothiest moth. I'm no scientist, and I don't find it at all easy to understand the higher concepts of evolutionary science, such as mitochondrial Eve, but I once had an experience that may be worth sharing. I visited the Orkney Islands, and on the southernmost island there's a museum, it's a living museum, called the Tomb of Eagles. The farmers who farmed the patch of ground discovered an ancient tomb. And you can go to the farmhouse, as I did, and be taken around the finds by the farmer, and then her husband takes you out to see the tomb. Well, when I walked in, Vera dropped into my hand a human skull. "Here's your grandma," she said, 200 generations back. She explained the way that generations work, how our family trees are always reducing further and further back inwards over time, to such a point that all of us who are alive today, all of us who are here, can be fairly confident that we are indeed related to the skull that I held in my hand. Grandma. The Tao Te Ching begins with a recognition that the name that can be spoken is not the eternal name. I think there's a trace of that same wisdom in the refusal of Judaism to name God. I often indeed also think that the reticence of some Unitarians to confine their conception of divinity within a single name carries an echo of that same wisdom, however unconsciously. The great name, I Am That I Am, carries for me the sense of all common names, the name of all names. It seems to carry for me a hint that our own names, the names of apples, the names of fields, remind us that the divine is embedded in our everyday experience, and we can hear its echo wherever we listen. Thank you.